Hello and welcome to the Risk Map podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker, dialing in from London.
And I'm Jackie Day, calling in from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the podcast. This week, Chuck and I are going to talk with Julia Zeno, our senior analyst for Southeast Asia, about critical peace talks in Myanmar, one of Asia's most important emerging economies.
Jackie, then we're going to go to Colombia and talk about the signing of a landmark peace agreement there. Colombia still has quite important strides to make in the future, but peace with the Revolutionary Armed Forces, known as the FARC, is a significant step towards unlocking that country's considerable economic potential.
Finally, we visit the Adriatic coastal country of Croatia, where upcoming elections will put the country on course to form their new government.
Jackie, to what extent does the world cling to an outdated image of Colombia, the kind of picture associated with cocaine and kidnapping? Is it time for all of us to do a big refresh?
Yes, Chuck. Colombia has been indeed evolving at an accelerated pace in the last few years, but it still has a way to go in revamping its image from the Pablo Escobar days. Sergio Guzman, one of our newest Latin American analysts, tells us what to expect from the peace agreement with the FARC, one of the world's most notorious paramilitary organizations.
So, Sergio, in contrast to the excitement internationally about the peace deal, there's a lot of opposition within Colombia itself. Can you help us understand the key elements of the Colombian perspective?
Right, and thank you so much, Jackie, for this opportunity. Colombia has been through 52 years of war, and this is a very confusing time for everybody. The government is very optimistic that the peace agreement will allow for an opportunity to address structural reforms that the country needs to face. The opposition is concerned that the government has been too lenient in terms of transitional justice, political participation, and reparations of the victims of the FARC. Particularly concerning is the fact that the FARC will get a seat in Congress and in the Senate. For now, temporary with a voice and no vote, and from the next two electoral periods, they will also have special jurisdictions for seats in the House and the Senate. The government has maintained that no peace agreement is perfect, and this peace agreement is the best negotiation that was possible and the most viable and implementable peace agreement. Yet the opposition feels that it could have obtained significantly more concessions from the FARC if it had been running the negotiations itself. Now, the contrast with international rejoice regarding the agreement is stark because international players are seeing that the agreement heralds a new time for Colombia, one where it can focus on solving some of its most pressing structural issues on inequality, poverty, and injustice, and so there are very interesting and complex times ahead.
So with all that in mind then, Sergio, what do you see are the key risks and opportunities for business as a result of the peace deal?
I believe that there are important opportunities and at the same time risks. For now, let's just say because we're uncertain regarding the outcome of the October 2nd plebiscite and the government's agenda on post-conflict implementation, we foresee that there are more challenges than opportunities, yet there are both. In the first place, the fact that there is peace with the FARC does not mean that there are not other criminal actors operating in Colombia, such as the ELN and other organized groups, which will continue attacking critical infrastructure, committing kidnaps or other high-profile moves in an effort to persuade or pressure the government into negotiations themselves. The ELN have not shown themselves prone to starting a peace process anytime soon. Communities themselves might also be looking for an immediate peace dividend in terms of the neglect that they have suffered from the state for more than 200 years of abandonment and will try to stage protests or blockades, trying to pressure the government and the private sector to meet some of the basic unsatisfied needs that there may be still. In addition, the negotiation posits that there will be a truth commission where not only members of the FARC, the military, and third parties will have to disclose or at least contribute to the integral reparation of victims and take some sort of stand on what were the crimes committed during the course of the conflict. And unfortunately, there's still many doubts remaining about what the role of the private sector will be in these discussions. Finally, the government, regardless of the plebiscite being passed or not, is going to have to implement tax reform as the country's deficit continues to grow as a result of the fall in commodity prices. It is projected that the government is going to have to introduce tax reform before the end of the year so that it can maintain its investment grade with the rating agencies by not borrowing significantly more money. This is a tax increase that is projected to affect more individuals than it is businesses, according to OECD recommendations, but it is yet to be determined what is contained in the tax reform as it will be presented after the plebiscite is passed. But at the same time, the agreement heralds important opportunities, particularly in a chance to restoring or restarting community relationships on behalf of firms working in territory, lowering security expenses as a result of a significant downfall in crimes committed by the FARC and a significantly reduced threat by that group. It is yet to be determined what kind of tax incentives and tax benefits will be received by firms investing in territories that have been affected by conflict. They have been announced by the government, yet a nuanced packet of incentives has not been announced. And at the same time, there will be important reputation advantages to firms willing to invest in peace in Colombia that might bring some important or at least some very interesting opportunities for the private sector engaging in initiatives regarding reconciliation, historical memory, transition, or strengthening of local capacity. So we envision that this might be positive for the private sector as well.
Thanks for taking us through those, Sergio. I guess to round out the discussion then, it would be good to understand and hear from you what we can expect in terms of next steps and overall outlook for Colombia following the plebiscite.
Right. So the first and most important thing to look out for is the plebiscite, which will take place on October 2nd. We expect that the result will be yes vote by the people of Colombia, although maybe by a slim margin, given the strong opposition, which I mentioned earlier, followed by the introduction of the tax reform. And then the process will be as follows. There will be a six-month stabilization phase where the FARC will transition into 31 different territories across the country, followed by an 18-month period where the government will stabilize territories, which will be followed by a 10-year implementation phase for the agreements, which will include the rural and land cadastre. It will include the transition of government functions and the strengthening of the state in rural areas and the consolidation of military power, which will be then followed by a 10-year consolidation period to make sure that the agreements are solidified in territories themselves. So we expect that this is going to be a period of increased volatility, yet it is going to be a transition into a more peaceful scenario, heralding an opportunity for Colombia and for private businesses investing in the country itself.
Thanks for sharing your insights with us today, Sergio.
Pleasure.
Investors stampeded into Myanmar, a country formerly known as Burma, when the military dictatorship there liberalized the country's political system and held national elections. That process brought Nobel laureate and former dissident Aung San Suu Kyi close to the pinnacle of power. But there, too, crucial steps toward broader stability remain. Our senior analyst for Myanmar tells us a little bit more.
Julia, a much-anticipated peace conference, the so-called 21st Century Panglong Peace Conference, kicked off on the 31st of August in the capital of Naypyidaw. Representatives of the new semi-civilian government, ethnic minority insurgent groups, and the military will be attending the conference, which should discuss how to solve the ethnic conflicts that have plagued Myanmar's border areas since independence. Julia, you follow this country closely. Tell us what makes this conference so important.
Well, the 21st Century Panlong Peace Conference is mainly symbolic, and it's a symbolic milestone in the peace process with ethnic minority armed groups. It takes the name from the Panlong Peace Conference, which was the first held in 1947, and this promised ethnic minority groups a federal union, although the governments after that never quite fully implemented this pledge, and this in part triggered ethnic conflict in several border areas of Myanmar in the 50s and in the 60s, and many of them continue today. So there are many reasons why this particular peace conference is going to be very important. It's the first high-profile meeting of this sort under the new government and the start of a very long peace process which Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy, will now lead. More importantly, it's very significant because it aims to bring all ethnic minority armed groups together to the same table. And this has long been a demand of ethnic minorities, but previous military governments insisted on bilateral ceasefires and negotiations in a sort of divide and rule effort. So the 21st Century Panlong Conference aims to sort of bridge this gap and bring all the groups together to the same table, although this has not been easy at all.
Julia, what can we expect as an outcome of the conference?
The conference itself is not going to bring any immediate or tangible results. It is only the start of a very long and an extremely difficult peace process, which is not going to be concluded for years, most likely for decades. The fundamental problems underlying ethnic conflict are so complex, and there's so many significant interests at play that obviously it is going to take a long time. These problems range from questions like, should non-state armed groups remain armed? And if they do, who should control them? Or more importantly, how much political authority can be given to ethnic minority areas? Or again, how far is it possible to meet ethnic minorities' demands for federalism without amending the constitution the former military junta put in place? This is a particularly sticky point, the one surrounding federalism, because the military has been traditionally justifying its need to remain in power on an argument that it was the only institution able to maintain national unity and to prevent Myanmar from collapsing effectively. There is also, of course, a very important and highly complex economic dimension. Ethnic minority leaders, government officials, the military, they've all benefited greatly from this economy of war, and they've had access to national resources like timber and gems and even narcotics in some cases. And understandably, they of course fear that a peace economy will require them to give up this access. Another major problem is the lack of trust between ethnic minorities and the army, but also between ethnic minorities and Aung San Suu Kyi herself.
Julia, this isn't the first time that you and I have gotten together to talk about Myanmar, and you've previously mentioned how ethnic conflict remains a major obstacle, an impediment to doing business and trading with Myanmar. What's your view and what are the outlooks for a sustainable peace?
I think, as we mentioned earlier, it's going to be years, if not decades, before we can see security risks in insurgency-affected border areas to decrease and stabilize to a point where foreign businesses are going to feel really comfortable operating there. To some extent, some areas have improved after the 2015 nationwide ceasefire was signed, and this has been particularly the case in southeastern Myanmar. But low-level conflict still continues, and conflict in border areas does not only pertain to those businesses that want to operate there, that are trading with Myanmar going through its borders, but they also have repercussions at the central level and nationwide, in the sense that relations between the ruling party and the ethnic minorities will shape national level political stability in the coming years. So the future of the peace process is very significant in this respect.
Julie, I'm looking forward to talking to you again when the peace process is over, or at least for an update as it continues to move forward. Julie Zeno, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On the coast of the crystal blue Adriatic Sea, Jackie, Croatia is undergoing an important transformation. In the wake of the recent resignation of the center-right government led by Prime Minister Tihomir Orsković, the country is going to the polls. We believe a victory by the center-left Social Democrat Party, led by a former prime minister, is going to win. I'm joined today in London by Sveta Kanesko, who's our senior analyst for Southeast Europe. Sveta, before we look to the future of Croatia, can you give us a bit of background on why the current government collapsed?
Well, what happened in Croatia was that in June, after only 6 months in office, the coalition between the conservative Croatian Democratic Union and the liberal MOST fell apart. It was an unstable coalition government led by an independent, politically unaffiliated former businessman, Tihomir Orešković, as prime minister. Orešković struggled to reconcile the pressures of the two political parties in government, and ultimately the Croatian Democratic Union voted no confidence in him, bringing the whole government down. But behind this, there was a dispute about high-level political corruption. The leader of the Croatian Democratic Union, Tomislav Karamarko, a deputy prime minister, was reported not to have disclosed potential conflict of interest over his wife's public relations consultancy fees in relation to a high-profile privatization case. In response to this, most deputies joined the opposition to vote no confidence to Karamarko. To retaliate, the Croatian Democratic Union brought the whole government down.
Sete, thanks for that piece of background. I suppose it's not too surprising to hear that corruption is behind the collapse of a government. Corruption is high on many national agendas around the world, so it's interesting to see that the same sort of problems have taken root in Croatia as well. Sete, tell us, who do you think is going to win the elections?
So most likely, it's the opposition center-left Social Democrats. They were in government until November 2015, and they will most likely win most votes. But they are not likely to win a majority, so we will most likely see another coalition government. MOST, again, is the prime candidate for junior coalition partner because they look like they're going to come third again. But there are other smaller parties vying for the growing protest vote in the country. So I think we could see a newcomer to the political scene winning enough votes to enter parliament and even in government.
Sete, Croatia is a small country in Southeast Europe. It's got a beautiful coastline along the Adriatic Sea. But tell us a little bit about why this is important. What does it mean for business? And what does it mean more broadly on a regional scale?
Well, under the new social democratic government, politics is likely to be less nationalist and less protectionist, so the overall business environment is likely to improve. In addition to that, relations with neighboring countries, especially Serbia, which have been strained under the previous government, are also likely to become more relaxed. But more broadly, the fall of the previous government alerts to a gradual but fundamental change in Croatia's political culture. Corruption is slowly becoming unacceptable. With Karamarko's resignation from the government and party leadership, a clear message is being sent that opaque links between politicians and businesses are becoming a thing of the past. Of course, this change will be slow and gradual, but it is certainly good news for foreign investors and businesses operating in Croatia, as well as tourists going to visit Croatia's magnificent coast.
Sete, this is an interesting potential outcome. Keep your eye on Croatia for us for the next few months, and we'll come back later and talk about that in an upcoming podcast. Until then, Sete Koneska, Senior Analyst, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chuck, thanks. Before we close out today's podcast, let's talk about a few other issues on our list for the next couple of weeks.
Jackie, voters in Nigeria's Edo state are going to the polls on the 10th of September to choose a new governor. We expect tensions to be high on Election Day.
And U.S. President Barack Obama and other international leaders will be visiting Laos in the first weeks of September for the East Asia Summit in Vientiane. A host of regional security issues are on the agenda.
Jackie, on Sunday, the 11th of September, we mark the anniversary of the 1973 military coup by General Augusto Pinochet in Chile. Unrest in Chile is likely on the day. The 11th of September, of course, also marks the 15th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the United States.
Chuck, we've got 2 weeks of more geopolitics to look forward to until the next Risk Map podcast. Until then, thanks very much for the chat, and to our listeners, thanks for clicking in. Talk to you again soon from the U.S.
And from London, thanks, Jackie, and bye for now.